And welcome to Backstage Pass, a spinoff of the Rock and Roll Survivors podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. I'm Kristen, and I'll be talking with music writers, podcasters, photographers, promoters, groupies, and so many others who love rock and roll. So here's your Backstage Pass. Let's get started. Welcome back to Backstage Pass. Madeline Beccaro, the extraordinary author of the book In Your Mind, The Infinite Universe of Yoko Ono. I'm thrilled to have you back. We kicked off Backstage Pass as a homage to Yoko Ono on February 18th, her 91st birthday of this year, 2024. We did a great series of interviews, and then we just had on your friend and another fantastic writer, Lori Kay, her book, Confessions of a Rock and Roll Name Dropper, My Life Leading Up to John Lennon's Last Interview. And then I was lucky enough to have the two of you on together. But we are now embarking on a new series of interviews with just you. And this is a complete shout out to your fan and Yoko's fan, Cindy Lee. Thank you, Cindy Lee, for recommending this. And her word was she demanded more interviews after our last series. And so we're going to do a few more interviews, at least for now, dedicated to Cindy Lee. And I wanted to kick off this first episode by reading Cindy's review of your incredible book. And I really think it sets the stage of what we're going to be talking about on this first episode, as well as the other two. So Cindy's review says, quote, "Most important book written about Yoko Ono. Being a fan and lover of Yoko for many decades, I have had the magical experience of reading this book and falling in love with her again and again as I turn each page. Madeline's book is like stepping into Yoko's world and never wanting to leave. The beauty of this book is that you never have to leave. I can open to any page and time travel. I think I'm there with Yoko, John, and all of the people in their lives. Because Madeline writes the book through Yoko's own words, we learn everything there is to know about this incredible woman who has influenced our world in such a unique way. Madeline debunks all the lies and delights us with the things we didn't know. If you are a fan, you will be overjoyed with the book. It will be a treasure to keep close to you. If you're not a fan, you will become one. Yoko and John's love story unfolds in a beautiful way and reaches out through the pages. We see Yoko as the brilliant artist she is on her own, before and after her time with John. I can't find the words to give the book the justice it deserves. You must read it and be a believer. Thank you, Madeline, for sharing this brilliant masterpiece about such an incredible woman." Close quote. So welcome back to Backstage Pass, Madeline.
Thanks so much, Christian. I really appreciate this.
Of course, I am so excited to have you. And so on this first episode, having you back, I really wanted to touch upon something that Cindy wrote within this review, because I think it's important. I'm a huge fan of Yoko Ono's, and I have been for decades. So this to me was just the cherry on top. And I mean, it was the entire meal, if you will, because your book is just perfect to me. But she writes, "If you are a fan, you will be overjoyed with the book." Could not agree with her more. "And it will be a treasure to keep close to you." And I said to you recently, Madeline, this book has become like a constant companion for me to be inspired. And then she ends with, "And if you are not a fan, you will become one." But as I've been thinking about it, I think there's a middle ground here for those who are steadfast and adamant in not wanting to become a fan of Yoko Ono's. And I think that they are deserving of the respect to at least tease out why that might be. And I recently was talking to a dear friend of mine who grew up with the Beatles. He's a music aficionado. And he said something that sparked in me this conversation that I want to have with you to start with Yoko Ono's artwork, which is, he said, "I've never blamed Yoko Ono for breaking up the Beatles. I never did." He said, "I just never got it in terms of her artwork and her music." And he said, "So it was me. I didn't get it. And so the only thing I saw was that John Lennon's music changed from the Beatles." And my friend said, "And then I didn't get it from him." Mm-hmm. And I thought that was an interesting way of approaching it. And so I want you to talk to that person. And how would you now expose them and introduce them to this artist named Yoko Ono and what her art meant? And you've picked some pieces from your book. And I just want you to take the stage and just roll with it.
Okay. Well, first of all, the problem was that whenever John and Yoko were interviewed, she was with him by then. So it was always about what he was doing, what they were doing together. But she had been an artist for many, many years before she met him, and she was never asked in depth about that. And even if she was, she never really liked to explain her work because it was really something she was giving to us to interpret ourselves. And it was all about nurturing and healing because of the traumatic childhoods that she had, the severe loneliness that she had growing up in a very wealthy family, not knowing her father until she was 3 years old, not having much affection. And, it's a shame that something that's so important and beautiful and giving is looked upon as something negative when it never got the attention and the explanation it deserved. And then the other aspect of it, that the art books that are written about her work are over intellectualizing it. Her art is very simple and straightforward and very easy to understand. So that's probably where everybody's getting a misunderstanding.
I think that's a perfect bookends to both of those ideas. And I think if we can pull back the lens a little bit, that negativity about her artwork and the over-intellectually, I can't even say it, the overthinking in the art history books, I think is intimidating. And I went back to school late in life. I didn't start until my late 30s, and I minored in art history. And I always loved Yoko Ono. I never, ever, was disinterested in her art, but I too didn't get it. But when I was exposed to it, I remember thinking instantly, my gosh, no wonder she's so misunderstood. It's been overthought, it's been seen as a negative to the Beatles. And I do think that if you're afraid of this idea of so-called modern art and you haven't been exposed to it, you are going to inherently reject it. Have you seen
Right.
that?
And she didn't really even have that many exhibitions once she met John. There was a big one they had in 1971 at the Everson Museum in Syracuse that went on for about a week. And people enjoyed that. It was fantastic. It was the whole scene. But then there was nothing, no exhibitions of her own. She did events with John, the bed-ins, the acorn piece, the war is over posters, the music. But there was no space to go and see her work. And as a matter of fact, right now in London at the Tate Modern, there's a huge exhibition on through September, and it's getting amazing reviews. The headlines are saying things like the Beatles are an afterthought, John Lennon is in the shadows. People are walking through all her white spaces, interacting with the work. Children are really grooving on it. And it's getting tremendous. Oh, this is what she did. This is what she's about. I'm coming out of here feeling enlightened and refreshed and healed. And that's what it's all about.
Well, I want you to talk about her art that you've chosen, but that just reminds me of our conversation on previous episodes when John Lennon came to her show at, and remind me the name, was it Indica? At the
It was
Indica.
at Indica Gallery, yes.
And he had been so turned off by this idea of modern art and pop art and just saw everything as so negative. And when he walked in there, he was and saw what she was doing. It was a breath of fresh air. It was inspiring. And he thought, this is it. This is not only an intellectual, conceptual art that I can get into, but it's uplifting. And that's what he was looking for.
Right. And he described it once as when, rock and roll music had become like a drag also. And then pop came up about and it became really exciting when, rock and roll came. And he just saw that in the art world, like even with Warhol and just the colorful and simplicity of modern art that wasn't pretentious and negative, that was kind of making a statement, a social statement.
So why don't you make a social statement about Yoko Ono and tell us which pieces you have chosen and why?
Okay, well, the first one is actually it's called Painting to Be Stepped On, and it's from 1964, and it started as an instruction. It's about courage and conviction, really. The instruction is to leave a piece of canvas or a painting on the floor or out in the street. And eventually it became a piece of canvas that was cut out and exhibited. So the idea for this stems from the Japanese fumi-e, meaning stepping painting. And this is the description of it from her Inzaga catalog in 1966. She wrote, in the 15th century Japan, a stepping painting was used to distinguish Christians from non-Christians. A person was asked to step on the portrait of Christ. Those who could not were immediately taken away to be crucified. Most Japanese Christians refused to step on the portrait despite the consequences which they were aware of. As a young child, I was terrified by the story, but I also promised myself that I would be a person who adhered to her principles just as the Japanese Christians did. Later in New York, I felt to release myself from that little girl in me and to step on a painting.
Well, it's just fantastic. So describe how this plays out for people that don't necessarily understand this. There's literally a canvas put down.
There's a canvas put down. So some people think, what's this? Stupid. John has a joke. He says, oh, no respect for art, huh? And he's stepping on it. But when you know the meaning, it's really heavy. This is one of her pieces that's a very heavy meaning behind something very simple. And aside from this meaning, when she's seeing people stepping on it, it is like she always thought of art shouldn't be something hanging on a wall and worshipped and respected and given a monetary value. She never expected to make any money from her work. It was just an exercise, a communication. So this piece to me is just one of the most important because it shows her mission, which is to, keep the integrity and show what happened to these people who had such integrity not to step on the painting of Christ, though they would be killed. And but then this was her release. She's like, I'm going to step on this now. Like she wanted to free herself from that. So this is a very heavy one, I think.
It's very heavy, but it also reminds me of a previous conversation we had, which is she just continues to amaze me, inspire me, impress me, whatever the words are, that she did grow up in a world of severe trauma. And she did live a life, for the most part, in survival mode. And yet she kept this optimism, but yet she was never in denial about that. It was never as if I'm going to compartmentalize. She actually went through the pain. And I'm just reading. I could read your whole book to our listeners, but there's one quote that she says, this is Yoko in July 2016 on the BBC radio. She says, thank God they criticized me instead of ignoring me. Can you imagine if everyone was saying, she's so good? She says, I'd be dead by now. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of, again, going through this pain, this heavy intent with this piece, but also the liberation of it. And it strikes me, and I think about you a lot, Madeline, with this of, yes, Yoko Ono understands and recognizes, or maybe she has to, that her survival mode elevated her as an artist. But you like to say, what if she hadn't had to go through that trauma? What would she have been allowed to create? So how do you deal with
if the burden would have been lifted, if she was freer and she would have done more? I don't know. I mean, we'll never know, but I mean, I think she really did enough, though. We have a huge body of work to look at, and it's also meaningful.
Absolutely. So tell us the next Yoko Ono piece that you love.
So this one is, it's called Disappearing Piece or Heavily Bandaged Box. So there's a disappearing piece, and it has a label on it that says the object in this box evaporates when exposed to light. And the heavily bandaged box was a little box wrapped in bandages with the same instruction. It kind of says, this box contains something very, very beautiful and only one person saw it. But the only drawback is that this beautiful thing is so sensitive to light that when you open it under the light, it disappears. So you have to first imagine what was this beautiful thing? And you're having this elevated feeling like, wow, this was something so beautiful. But I can't open this box because it's going to disappear and I'll never see it. So that's kind of cool. And I just think the elements of transience and intangibility that represents all the fleeting moments of her own life and all that was taken away from her because she was evacuated from her home and she saw when she came back Tokyo in ruins. And, you know, she was never really able to hold on to anything tangible. So that's why all her pieces are just an instruction or a word or an object, you know, that she really just tries not to put value on anything too much because it will be taken away. Like the apple, her apple, for example, will deteriorate and become nothing. So that's what she's all about.
It just strikes me, and tell me if I'm reading too much into this, but I want to pull back on what you're saying. If it's about her childhood and it's this tender box wrapped in a bandage, which of course is about wounding and healing all at the same time, and there's so much in the Western world and idea of art history of let the light in, you know, cast away with the dark. But in her case, by letting the light in, she was exposed to this horror. She could no longer contain her thoughts in a darkness that was still unreal.
Right. And in, you know, in the Imagine film, that when John's singing Imagine at the white piano, Yoko's opening the curtains and letting all the light in. And by the end of the video, it's all bright white. So that's kind of disappearing piece in reverse. And it's also related to she has a piece called Men Piece where she'll wrap a person. She did it on the, what's his name? Not Jules Holland, that other guy, Jonathan Ross show in England. And she's wrapping him and he's joking around, whatever. And he's saying, oh, this is interesting. And she goes, well, I only understand about pain because I'm like a nurse in a way, conceptually. So it's really about healing, you know, protection.
Absolutely. Catharsis too.
Mm-hmm. And she has a piece, Sky Piece for Jesus Christ, which was JC really stands for John Cage, right? But they revered him so much that, you know, she gave him that nickname. And
well,
she
well, before you go on, because I want people to really understand this. For those who don't know who John Cage is, can you tell us his significance and who he was?
Yeah, John Cage was a composer who was interested in sound and the absence of sound. And could there possibly ever be an absence of sound? And he did all these kind of experiments and pieces, and he had a lot of humor in his work as well. And he was in New York giving lectures at a college, and Yoko's husband, or future husband, Toshiichi Inagi, was a student of John Cage. So that's how Yoko got involved, and she performed with them in New York and Japan. And they were very, very close colleagues throughout their lives.
Well, I want to hear about the piece, but it strikes me from your book that there is an anecdote she talks about, but that you quote Yoko Ono on, that she was always interested, even as a child, of the absence of sound. So that when her school clock went off and school was let out, she didn't count the time, she counted the silence in between.
And the ticking of the clock, yeah.
And so, of course, she would be drawn to John Cage. So I didn't mean to interrupt. So now tell us this piece.
Right. So the Sky Piece for Jesus Christ was basically an orchestra is playing and she's rapping all the members of the orchestra until their instruments become muffled and then silent. So that was just another aspect of Men's Piece.
So before we move on to the other pieces, have you ever seen any of this in real time? Have you been to any of the exhibits? Obviously, you were too young as a kid, but in any recreations or newer exhibits?
Yeah. I've been to many, many of them. The first really, after the 1971 exhibition, which I was too young to go to, but I did see it on television. It was televised on PBS and it was cool. It was black and white, but I did, you know, get the gist of everything. It was cool. And then at the Whitney in 1989, it all evolved because of John Cage's birthday, which was, what do you call that word? Like, uncanny in two ways, because it was because of John Cage's birthday that she approached Paul McCartney for manuscripts because they were making a book for him. And this was before she really knew how important the Beatles were, that her husband at the time sent her to go ask Paul McCartney, maybe, you know. And then for John Cage's birthday in 1989, she had made another, I'll talk about the play by chess set, and she did some pieces for him. And then the Whitney Museum asked her, hey, should we do a retrospective of your work? And she said, sure. So they did that in 1989. So I did that. And then they, MoMA, Museum of Modern Art in New York in 2015, had a Yoko Ono one-woman show, which she had dreamt up in 1971. She had sent her representative there with a sandwich board that said Yoko Ono show today. And he was asking people when they came out, did you see this Yoko Ono show? It's just this imaginary thing. And the management called her up and said, hey, are you claiming that you have a show here? She put ads in the Village Voice and everything. And she said, oh yeah, but don't worry about it. It's only in my mind. So then in 2015, it becomes a reality, like three floors of MoMA, Yoko exhibition all summer. I was there almost every day. She did, they showed her films. She did talks and concerts during that time. It was fabulous. Spent the whole summer there.
That is fantastic. And that's a complete reason why manifestation matters. She made that happen. And I love that it was in her mind. I love, that's fantastic. So continue with the other pieces of hers that you love.
So another one is called Half a Wind. It's a room, but really half a room because it's open. You're looking into it. So it's half a room. It's all painted white and all the objects and furniture are cut in half. So, you know, it's intending viewers to imagine the other half, to focus on the negative space and determine for themselves if the room is half empty or half full, however you want to look at it. And we can't help see the half that's there, but she's actually showing us the half that's missing. And she said once on Instagram, like, the world of halves is visible. It even has a vibration like classical music. Like, she can hear these invisible things. This is how evolved she is. And it was always fascinating to me how intuitive, perceptive, and just otherworldly really she is.
I have two thoughts on that. I mean, first of all, I completely agree with you. That's fantastic. But she is that intuitive and insightful because people who lose limbs feel it. It's still there for them. Right, so there is something there. So that half space. But it also reminds me in your book that when she was first conceiving of grapefruit at the age of 4, and this whole idea of what if you took, is it a lemon seed and an orange seed, and you cut them in half and you put it together, and that if you grew them, but that she was so young that she had to have an older playmate
write them down.
These
she didn't know how to write yet. Yeah.
She didn't know how to write. She's 4 years old. I mean, I just love her, the way her mind works.
She says she always felt like Madame Curie inventing all these important things, but nobody would listen to her, understand. So yeah, and this work is also based on feelings of emptiness and feeling that was a half a empty space in her life because her relationship with her second husband was waning. And, you know, she even hears the negative space, the silence in between the ticking of the clock, like we said.
Oh, that's incredible. And say again the year that she did this.
This was from 1967.
So this is all at the same time where her marriage is waning. She's meeting John Lennon. So it's also interesting to think about, maybe it's the collapse of her relationship. I don't know what was going on with her daughter at the time. But again, it's this heavy commentary, and yet it's so inspiring to create your own idea of what a half or negative space means to you. She's continually giving as an artist.
Right.
So keep going. I love this.
So then there's one called Three Spoons. It's also from 67. And it was actually on a pedestal, 4 silver spoons. And it just exemplifies the illusions that we're presented with in life, you know, illustrating misinformation versus truth. And like, the fourth spoon isn't mentioned in the title. So you're looking, you know, questioning what you're seeing, which she wants you to do. Don't just accept what you're seeing. So, you know, it's a contrasting piece to Half a Wind. And in that one, we have to imagine the missing half. In this one, there's something there that shouldn't be there, according to the title of the piece. So, you know, it's very interesting.
Well, I also love the idea, and I don't know, again, if I'm overthinking this, but that it's a silver spoon, which is, of course, in Western culture, the idea that symbolizes wealth. There's four spoons. It could be the Beatles. I'm not sure if what the timing is there, but also that there's four, but it's called three. And there is this idea that she was a gold digger, which you completely debunk in your book. But that's been a myth that has perpetuated and started back then. So it's just another little, I always say about her, because she does have such a fantastic sense of humor. There's so many little wink, winks, nods, nods in her artwork.
Yeah. And then later on, she created a work called Four Spoons with an indent where the fourth spoon should be. It was three spoons. So she kind of reversed it. It was for the exhibition, the Bronze Age. It was bronze. And then the missing spoon, you know, could again represent the emptiness in her life, like the half a room. So yeah, that's a kind of a twist.
That's fantastic. Well, we are going to pick up on the next episode, continuing to talk about Yoko Ono's more artwork, some of her music, some of her compositions, because I think it's really important to contextualize Yoko Ono separate from what her life was with John Lennon. Not that her time with him isn't extraordinary, but I don't think you can understand what he fell in love with in terms of her artwork and her mind, and why he was never the same after meeting her. So, Madeline Beccaro, tell us where everybody can find, in your mind, the infinite universe of Yoko Ono.
Okay, so the hardcover and the softcover version are available through me at conceptualbooks.com. You can have the option of having it signed by me or not. And it's also on bookbaby.conceptualbooks.com. It's that site, Book Baby. It's on Amazon for those internationally who can get free shipping. And if you go into a bookstore, independent bookstores will have it, but the bigger chains might not have it on the shelves, but you can ask for it and they can order it for you.
Wonderful. And I want people to know about your background as well, because you have done a lot of writing your whole life, not just about Yoko Ono. So tell us about your blog and where they can learn more about you.
So I have a music blog. It's madelinex.com. And that's just all my writings I've done. I've started out at CMJ, which was College Media Journal, in 1978 as a staff writer and reviewing concerts and albums and all. And then I always had regular jobs because writing could not afford me to live alone in New York. So I always wrote on the side, whether it was freelance or just for my own recollections, diaries of every time I saw a concert, I'd write about it the next day. And I have just a lot of great memories and insights, and met a lot of the idols in my childhood. And it was just wonderful meeting them all and getting to know them. So yeah, there's a lot on that blog.
Well, you're a fantastic writer all around. But since I want everybody to go out and get your book, I want people to take this as a compliment, because I mean this so sincerely. This is one of the most approachable books I have ever read on Yoko Ono, because, and I'm quoting you on this, these are all a cast of characters you know, but you get to understand it in a way where it's just a whole different perspective, and you get to understand what the Beatles thought of her and why they were encouraging John to be with her. So I'm really thrilled that you're back. I'm so excited for the next episode so we can learn more about Yoko Ono. And to quote Cindy Lee before we close out this episode, Madeline, thank you for sharing this brilliant masterpiece about such an incredible woman. So until then,